Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
And now the final part of our history series, The Crescent and the Cross, on clashes between Christianity and Islam. This week, the Islamic leader who confronted the British Empire. The presenter is Owen Bennett-Jones.
In the final programme of this BBC series, how Queen Victoria's Britain, the mightiest power on earth at the time, was humbled by one man. Born in 1844 in what is now Sudan, he proclaimed himself to be the Mahdi, the guided one, and said he had a divine mission.
The Prophet then appeared to me in a vision and said, "You will pray at Khartoum, you will pray in Mecca, then in the mosque at Medina, then in the mosque at Cairo, then in the mosque in Jerusalem. May God grant that we do indeed pray in all these mosques and finally die as martyrs at the hands of the infidel."
In fact, his enemy became the martyr. Well, I'm in Khartoum in the bright sunshine now, enjoying a cappuccino with someone who knows the Mahdi story as well as anyone, because I'm with Dr. Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi, who's the Mahdi's great-great-granddaughter and also an aspiring politician. And Dr. Mariam, your forebears used to make ships, your family used to make ships here on the River Nile. But your great-great-granddad always had bigger ideas, basically, didn't he?
He himself, from the beginning, he was disinterested in being a manufacturer of ships. From the very early beginnings, he showed a lot of interest in pursuing knowledge.
He was a very devout young man, I think. I mean, he used to take off for weeks, eating virtually nothing and just praying.
Oh, yes, and this is part of Sufism, of how you train the body to be meager in the materialistic needs. When he would feel hungry, he would go to the river and just throw the fishing hook without putting a bait in it. And he would say he wouldn't cheat anything, not even the fishes, he wouldn't cheat.
You're saying he would not bait his fishing hook?
Yes.
For fear that that was what, unfair to the fish?
Yes, that is cheating to the fish. And if he gets a fish, that is what Allah brought to him. And if not, that is his fate.
Anything to do with the Mahdi is the subject of some reverence in Sudan. And I'm now at the National Records Office. It's the National Archive. And his papers are being preserved here. There are thousands and thousands of documents. And I'm with Dr. Ali Salih Karar, who for 13 years was in charge of this treasure trove of information and ancient documentation. Let's just pick up the Mahdi story, because he's getting a following, he's a holy man, he's recognised as such, but he manages to turn that into a political movement. How does he do that?
He was very charismatic himself, and he appealed to a number of Sudanese people because he claimed to be a descendant of the Prophet, and he used to travel intensively in the Sudan himself. He declared himself in 1881, and then he managed to form a state, which is known as the Mahdist state, in 1885.
It is amazing, isn't it? In 4 years, this movement just swept across.
Swept, yeah. And you know, this is why the people believe that he was the true Mahdi, and he was divinely guided, not for human being, you know, to do such a miraculous thing, you know. And in the ultimate end, he managed to establish a state.
And the other way he spread his message, we can see here at the archive, because he was constantly writing proclamations and edicts and fatwas and so on, and you've got some of them here.
We have in the National Records Office hundreds of these fatwas.
"Order your women, sons, daughters and slaves to perform the 5 mandatory prayers every day and beat them if they fail. Stop making, selling, and drinking alcohol in the markets. Spill it away and break the jars." A woman with uncovered hair, even for the blink of an eye, deserves 27 lashes. He who calls a fellow Muslim a dog, a pig, a Jew, a pimp, a dissolute, a thief, an adulterer, a fraudster, cursed, an infidel, a Christian or a sodomite, should be punished with 80 lashes and 7 days imprisonment.
And with those Taliban-like edicts, the Mahdi targeted what he saw as the corrupt metropolis of Khartoum. And I can see the modern city now, dilapidated, low-rise, and I can see it from the River Nile, because I'm on a boat on the Nile now, brown and murky, wide, slow. And back in 1884, the British General Charles Gordon was on this river, heading towards Khartoum, and his orders were not actually to fight the Mahdi, but to withdraw some Egyptian troops who were in the city, but he wanted to fight. And on board with me now is Gillian Slovo, who's writing a book about General Gordon. And one of the things to say, Gillian, is that he didn't like authority, did he?
He didn't like authority, and he didn't like polite society. I mean, Gordon was the man who famously, when the Prince of Wales honoured him by inviting him to dinner, said, "No, I can't come." And when the Prince of Wales aide said, "You can't do this, it's the Prince of Wales, what am I going to tell him?" Gordon said, "Tell him I go to bed early." So he was a man who didn't do very well when he was under command. At the same time, he appears to have been a man who, by the force of his piercing blue eyes, could make people follow him, could make people believe in him.
Well, I'm back on dry land now, 100 metres or so away from the river, and looking, indeed standing, on an enduring symbol of British colonialism. It is a British gunboat, still here over 100 years later, partly because it was lifted by a flood of the Nile at some stage and dumped here, and then became the headquarters of the Blue Nile Sailing Club. And I'm just clambering up on there's a wooden staircase onto the bridge, where waiting for me is Justin Willis. Now, he's an academic, a British academic, who studied Gordon. And one of the key points, Justin, was that General Gordon wasn't actually invading, was he? His orders were to pull out of Sudan.
Yes, he was sent to evacuate the Egyptian garrisons, but it was, I think, pretty clear even before he left that he had no real intention of doing that. He had shown very clearly in interviews with the press and in his publicly expressed opinions that he thought it would be better to face the Mahdi and that the Mahdi could be defeated.
For religious or for colonial or for nationalistic or for what reason?
That is a terribly interesting question, and I'm not sure it was actually any of those things. I think it was rather that Gordon had an extraordinary belief in himself.
So the two men were spoiling for a fight, and the scene was set for a major moment of British imperial history, the Siege of Khartoum. It's a story that entered the popular imagination and even got the Hollywood treatment. In reality, they never met, but inevitably, on the silver screen, they were shown in a dramatic encounter in a Bedouin tent.
Why do you invite me here now? Because the Prophet Muhammad, blessings be upon him, has appeared to me in a vision and instructed me to attack Khartoum with fire and sword.
In real life, of course, it was a little more complicated than that. I'm now at Khartoum University, previously called Gordon College, and I'm here to meet a man who is really the doyen of Sudanese historians. He's written a shelf load of books. His name is Professor Yusuf Fadl Hassan, and I want to ask him about the final confrontation between Gordon and the Mahdi.
The Mahdi by then had conquered most of the western part of the Sudan, a lot of the east. Large parts of the northern country were already in his command. And about 9 months, the city became isolated. In that isolation, Gordon began to feel the punch. He started making fortifications, one of which is only lie about 300 or 400 meters from here, especially where near the confluence of the two Niles, fortifications around the main gates.
Right, so this siege, now, nothing's allowed in, no food?
Nothing is allowed in. Food was running short. In the end, dead animals like donkeys, dogs, horses. That was the main food people eat. And people started leaving Khartoum, going to join the Mahdi.
He was encircled on three sides by the forces of the Mahdi. The Nile was going down, so his fortifications that he had made, which were basically out of mud, were no longer as good. And a relief force was on its way. And Gordon spent his last days at the top of his palace with an eyeglass looking up the Nile, hoping to see the steamer that he had sent as early warning, steaming back to tell him that the forces had arrived. They never did.
And then the forces of the Mahdi started getting closer and closer.
They were all around, and then one night they just crossed over. And of course the Mahdi's had hundreds of thousands, and Gordon had very few demoralised and hungry Egyptian soldiers.
Accounts of the time, and many subsequently, have suggested that the two men were bitter enemies with their different faiths and class backgrounds, meaning they held each other in mutual contempt. Professor Hassan again.
Both Gordon and Mahdi, I think they respected one another as human beings. The Mahdi himself, I think, thought highly of Gordon as a good Christian, compared with some of the Muslims whom he thought did not follow the teaching of Islam as such.
He thought Gordon was probably more religious than some of the Muslims.
Exactly. The Mahdi asked Gordon to surrender and even asked him to join Islam.
To become a Muslim?
Muslim. To save your soul.
It's unclear exactly how Gordon met his end, because the Mahdi had given instructions that Gordon should not be killed. So whoever killed Gordon was not going to tell the tale of how it had happened. But it appears that Gordon was beheaded in his palace, coming down the stairs, defending it, fighting, and was beheaded.
I don't think the Mahdi wanted Gordon to be killed. He frowned when they told him about that.
He frowned?
Yes. He wasn't happy at all.
The deed done, Gordon's head was presented to the Mahdi by some of his followers. And in London, the journalists had a hero.
Daily Telegraph. Daily Telegraph.
The Englishman has brought back to us the times and traditions of names which are the brightest jewels in our history.
Daily News. Daily News. Buy your daily
General
news.
Gordon will be remembered always in our history as the noblest type of warrior.
Pall Mall Gazette. Pall Mall Gazette.
He has done what he could. And the catastrophe which, with such heroic courage and such marvellous resource, he averted for a whole year, has at last overwhelmed him and those whom he sought to save.
What made Gordon so famous was the nature of his death. The fact that he had made this heroic stand, the fact that he hadn't given in, the fact that he hadn't been taken by the Mahdi and then apostatized, as many people did.
Fair to say that Gordon would rather have died than been captured and forced to convert.
Absolutely. He never would have converted. I mean, he had an enormous amount of contempt for people who did.
Well, Gordon, of course, was celebrated in Victorian Britain, and it was considered almost impossible to criticise him for a long time. And it's only really in more recent years that people have begun to see him as a rather more problematic character than the hero who was celebrated by Victorian Britain.
Why was that? Why was it so difficult to see Gordon as a man who'd actually disobeyed orders and caused havoc?
Because it was possible to project onto Gordon a series of the values of Victorian Britain. He was, if you like, a screen onto which a series of ideas about Victorian heroism and morality could be projected, as noble, self-sacrificing, devoted to duty, even though, in fact, of course, he neglected his duty in quite a serious way.
Justin Willis and Gillian Slovo. British accounts of Gordon the hero, obviously great in Sudan, but actually even more insulting to many Sudanese is the dismissive and sometimes sneering portrayals of the Mahdi. Professor Yusuf Hassan again.
The thing that which annoys one, the way that they sort of the people themselves, they call them savages, natives, barbarians. The Mahdi himself is a mad mullah, is a mad Mahdi. The Mahdi is to his people, he's a saint, a spiritual leader, a religious man, a just man.
Do you notice similar language today in terms of the discourse between the West and Islam?
I feel the West is not as kind to Islam as the Muslims think of Christianity as such. One feels the arrogance of the West itself as a civilization embedded in Christianity. It's there. That I feel it even today. And I don't think the West has changed its attitude.
There's a remarkable sight in front of me now. There's a group of around 20 men, and they're standing in a circle, and they're dancing and chanting, as you can hear. And this is a Sufi sect. And the prayer leader, who's got a magnificent gold-edged black robe, is instructing the drummers. And the men are rolling their heads from side to side, and they're getting into a state of religious ecstasy, really. And these ceremonies have been going on for centuries here, but when the British came across them, basically confirmed their ideas about the strangeness of what they saw as Muslim fanatics. And that is certainly how it seemed to a young Winston Churchill. Now, he was in Sudan after the death of Gordon, and here's part of what he wrote.
How dreadful are the curses which Mohammedanism lays on its votaries. A degraded sensualism deprives this life of its grace and refinement, the next of its dignity and sanctity. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world. Far from being moribund, Mohammedanism is a militant and proselytizing faith. It has already spread throughout Central Africa, raising fearless warriors at every step. And were it not that Christianity is sheltered in the strong arms of science, the civilization of modern Europe might fall as fell the civilization of ancient Rome.
For Churchill and his compatriots, the Mahdi's victory was a rare imperial defeat. But there were other ways of looking at it. Was the Mahdi really driven by anti-imperialism? Arguably, he was much more interested in purifying Islam and fighting Muslims, who he believed had become decadent and godless. Justin Willis from Durham University.
Well, of course, the Mahdi offers himself to multiple historical interpretations. For many modern Sudanese, he can be presented as the father of independence, the first person who fought for the Sudanese nation. I think this is entirely ahistorical. I think the Mahdi himself had very little idea of a Sudanese nation and certainly would have had no idea that he would be seen as the father of it in years to come. I think it's probably equally misleading to see him as in some way the leader of a crusade against Christian invaders. The Mahdi was, from his own point of view, I think, quite clearly interested in the revival of Islam, and his struggle was against corrupt Muslim rulers. The fact that there happened to be a Christian in charge in Khartoum at the time was not really germane from the Mahdi's point of view.
It does seem there are parallels with today. I mean, there is an Islamic revivalist movement going on at this moment, which, like the Mahdi, seems to go back to the Quran, back to the original text, say that Islam has been corrupted.
Yes, I think that's true. And the idea that leaders, that rulers of states in particular, have strayed from the proper way is an idea which has again and again informed Islamic movements over history. And the Mahdi belongs very much in that context.
The different perceptions of Gordon, dutiful Christian martyr or cruel imperialist, and the Mahdi, fanatical anti-British mullah or saintly national liberator, help illustrate how Christians and Muslims can misunderstand one another. But history is constantly being reassessed, and intriguing new evidence about the Mahdi has recently come to light. One of the remarkable things about Khartoum is that there's been a Greek community here since the 1820s, and they always have tended to observe things from the sidelines, trading, business and so on. And I'm with a social anthropologist, Gerasimos Makris, who's actually from Athens. Gerasimos, aren't you? But you have married into the Greek community here.
Absolutely. I think that my wife is the fourth generation Greek from Khartoum.
And you have made a rather remarkable discovery, because you found the diary of a man who came to Sudan from Greece in the 1880s.
Well, yeah, that's a fascinating story. This diary belongs to someone called Nicholas from the island of Samos, the Aegean Sea. So we have young Nicholas, who had some relatives down here in Khartoum, and he arrived just a few months before Mahdi captured the city.
It was actually terrible timing because he ended up getting caught up in this whole conflict and was basically captured.
Absolutely. He was supposed to stay here for 6 months, but he stayed for how long? 18 years or something.
And let me just explain also, we're in a little bit of Greece in Sudan. It's difficult to believe, really, but there's a whole compound here with the embassy, a Greek school, and it's also got a huge Greek Orthodox church, which has been here for over a century. We could be in central Athens. It's amazing.
Yes, it looks like the churches that we have in Athens.
So tell us a bit more about Nicholas. What did his diaries say about what happened when he was captured and when he actually met the Mahdi?
Nicholas met the Mahdi several times. They were all told by the Mahdi himself that they had to become Muslims and that they had to acknowledge him as the Mahdi of the Prophet Muhammad. May I quote from the diary itself? Yes, here it is. The Mahdi said that you can have whatever you like in your heart. We are not going to examine it.
Right, so quite pragmatic. He's basically saying, convert in public, but in private, believe what you want.
In effect, this is what he said.
I know you're a specialist in these events of 100 and 150 years ago, but when you see what's happening today in the war on terror and so on, do you see parallels between the way the Mahdi and Gordon are portrayed and the way the conflict today is portrayed?
Absolutely. On the one hand, we have Christian saints against terror, and on the other hand, we have Muslim villains going against civilization, I think. That's nonsense.
Those momentous events in Khartoum end our rapid tour of just a few episodes in Christian Islamic history involving the Crusaders, the Ottomans, and the Muslim rulers in Spain. Clashes between Christianity and Islam do recur, but there have also been long periods of relative harmony. Religious fervour in both faiths has waxed and waned. The passionate black and white arguments presented now and in the past by imams, popes, preachers, politicians, chroniclers, journalists, and fighters on both sides have been and still are plainly oversimplified. But there is normally a method to the propaganda. Some Christians and some Muslims alike use and misuse the past to justify their vision of the present and of the future too.
That was the last in the series of The Crescent and the Cross. The presenter was Owen Bennett-Jones, the producer David Edmonds, and the editor Jeremy Skeet.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.